what we're doing here that has been important for me and has changed over the years. Really asking, what in essence is this practice about? Or what is Buddhist practice about? Or what are we doing? What are we most essentially doing? And I'm going to share, in particular, an inquiry into the nature of dukkha and the teaching that the core of the practice is the end of dukkha. And I don't think I've really shared this in length. I looked over my talks to Marin Sangha, and I don't think I've given a sharing of this inquiry. Perhaps I have it in different ways, but I thought to share. So I'll do so initially autobiographically. So I came to Buddhist practice over 45 years ago. And I think I came to it with two backgrounds. One is I was in my early 20s and mid 20s. And I came to it with a background in activism and being interested in social issues and social change. And the other background that I came to meditation with was a limited but very important background with psychedelics. And so when I was initially practicing and I heard the teachings about dukkha, and dukkha was usually translated as suffering, and I said, well, you know, what are we doing? We want to end suffering. And my response was, I think that's for other people. I'm not really suffering. You know, what I'd like is to have really amazing states of consciousness. That's what brings me to meditation. Anyone relate to that from your own history? Okay, so some of us. And so the teachings about suffering and the end of suffering didn't really resonate so much initially. I started doing a number of retreats, and then difficult experiences soon surfaced. So I really did have a sense of of something like suffering, but not initially. And then I also was confused because as I explored the teachings about dukkha and the end of dukkha further, it seemed like dukkha wasn't really about pain as such, but it was some kind of resistance to pain. You know, so the end of practice wasn't to end painful experiences. And I was also quite confused about that, because that seemed like a good idea, and particularly from the standpoint of social justice and social issues. You know, what I was interested in was sort of ending unnecessary pain. And sometimes the message I got from the practice was that the aim of practice is not so much to end pain, but it's to have a different relationship to pain. And I wasn't always clear how this would fit with ending unnecessary social pain. So you can see that there was a certain amount of confusion. And as I went further, I think this confusion really about the aims of practice is rather widespread. Even to know what do the Four Noble Truths mean, I think there can be a lot of confusion about this. What does the end of dukkha mean? Dukkha is usually translated as suffering. Are we really going to get rid of suffering? What does suffering mean anyhow? Is suffering the same as pain? Is it different? So how many of you have some resonance with some of the what I'm naming as confusions, you know, about what we're doing, right? And so what I want to outline is a way of making some sense of why there are these confusions, and then clarifying, I think, with more precision what the most fundamental meaning of dukkha is and what the most fundamental meaning of the end of dukkha is. And some of this clarity about this only really came about for me in the last few years. And I came to see that in the teachings of the Buddha, there actually are multiple meanings of dukkha. There's not one meaning of dukkha. There are multiple meanings of dukkha, and it can be quite confusing. And so what I want to do is go through the meanings of dukkha that we find in the suttas, in the discourses of the Buddha. We know that it was an oral tradition, and so the Buddha didn't, as it were, think, oh, I've given all these discourses and I've given multiple meanings of dukkha and they're not all consistent. And, you know, I should clean it up. That didn't happen, right? That didn't happen with the Buddha. And so, yeah, so I think I'll do a kind of screen share to show and point to four basic meanings of dukkha that are there in the discourses. And what I'll suggest is that only the last of them helps us make sense of the very aim of the practice, which is to end dukkha. Okay. And so let me do the screen share now. I think this should work pretty well. Let's see. Okay. 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 Are you seeing my whole screen with different things, or are you just seeing? Are you just seeing four meanings of dukkha?
Just seeing four meanings of dukkha.
Okay, very good. Okay, that's good. I'm seeing something different. Okay, so let's go through these four meanings of dukkha. The first one is the one that leads to the translation of dukkha as suffering. And this is the most common. This is dukkha as what is unpleasant, what is difficult. This is where the Buddha continually says, or very often says, what is dukkha? Dukkha is birth. Dukkha is old age. Dukkha is sickness. Dukkha is death. And this is related probably to the core meaning of dukkha in the original language, sort of the everyday meaning of dukkha. The first part of the word means bad or difficult, and the kha means empty. And the common meaning in the ordinary language was that something is dukkha when there's an axle on a cart that doesn't sit well in its grooves. And so there's, as it were, a bumpy ride. And so this first meaning of dukkha is very, very common. And I think this leads to the very common translation of suffering. However, we now need to ask, does this help us make sense of what the Buddha says is the goal of practice, which is the end of dukkha? The Buddha says at one point, I teach dukkha and the end of dukkha. Sometimes that's translated as I only teach dukkha and the end of dukkha, but probably the better translation is just I teach dukkha and the end of dukkha, because he teaches other things. And so we can ask, does this kind of dukkha end? And the answer is clearly no. So this meaning of dukkha doesn't help us make sense of what the end of dukkha is. It doesn't help us make sense, at least directly, about the aim of practice, which is interesting. And the Buddha, in fact, had unpleasant experiences. And, you know, and when he was older, he had headaches and backaches. And so presumably, you know, and unpleasant experiences are part of apparently of being awake. So the end of dukkha is not what's referred to by this first meaning of dukkha. And this, similarly, I'll say with the second and third, the second meaning of dukkha, viparinama dukkha, is the discomfort of change. We can have pleasant experiences, and at a certain point, they will become, we have pleasant experiences, they will become unpleasant. This was another one of the meanings of dukkha that the Buddha gave. And again, does that ever end? No, that's just the way things are. And so it's another, we might say, aspect of things being unpleasant. Similarly, for the third meaning, which you'll sometimes hear in Dharma talks, this can help us understand the end of dukkha. This third one, sankhara dukkha, no conditioned experience can provide lasting satisfaction. That helps us kind of get at what I'm going to say is the main meaning of dukkha. But if we talk about technically the end of dukkha, it doesn't tell us what the end of dukkha is directly, because this kind of dukkha never ends. You know, lasting satisfaction is never given by a conditioned experience. So this kind of dukkha never ends. And so what I'm going to say, and I'll, is that the actually the core meaning of the end of dukkha is illuminated only by a teaching which comes out in the Two Arrows teaching and in Dependent Origination. And so I'll do the stopping of the screen share now, and I'll explain those teachings. And the you know, these are actually probably familiar, really, to many of us or most of us. I teach all the time on the Two Arrows because it was really the Two Arrows that started opening things up. It made some, gave some clarity about what the end of dukkha is. So I think, how many of you know the Two Arrows teaching? I think a really crucial teaching, it's the teaching, I'll give it briefly because not everyone knows it. The Buddha once asked, he said, everyone at times has unpleasant experiences. What differentiates a non-practitioner from a skilled practitioner? And they didn't answer. So he said, everyone at times has unpleasant experiences. This is like being shot by an arrow. This is the first arrow, so to speak. We're all at times experiencing what is unpleasant, unpleasant physical experiences, mental, emotional experiences, interpersonal experiences. We experience unfairness at times, injustice. This is the first arrow. Everyone experiences the first arrow. The Buddha said that what differentiates the non-practitioner from the skilled practitioner is that the non-practitioner, because of the presence of the first arrow, tends to shoot a second arrow, we might say at oneself or at others, as if this would get rid of the first arrow. And so, and what we'll see is that the skilled practitioner learns not to shoot the second arrow. How do we shoot the second arrow? When I'm experiencing something unpleasant physically, I will contract. I'll tense my body around what's unpleasant physically, or I might blame myself, or I'll blame someone else. You know, I stub my toe on something that my partner left in the living room. I blame my partner, right? Or I blame myself, or I instantly react back when someone says something I don't like, or I'm very reactive towards unfairness or injustice and so forth. That's shooting the second arrow. The skilled practitioner learns not to shoot the second arrow. And this is also, really a way of getting at what the teaching of the end of dukkha is. And one way that I used to do this was to say that the first arrow, I would make a technical, very, very clear distinction and say the first arrow is pain and the second arrow will define very precisely as suffering. That's not ordinary English usage in which pain and suffering often mean the same thing. But I used to say the second arrow is suffering, and that's makes sense of how we can get rid of suffering. If we have a very precise and limited definition of suffering as the second arrow. Over time, I've come to not like that resolution, mostly because of the ordinary English way that pain and suffering are not firmly distinguished. And so I've come to wanting to talk about the second arrow as reactivity. You know, as I've often, I think, mentioned in Marin Sangha, the teaching is brought out maybe even more clearly by what may be the most fundamental teaching of the Buddha, the teaching of dependent origination. And I'll go to another screen share and show something that, again, I think I've taught about from time to time. And here we go here. And so are you just seeing the sequence of contact to grasping? Seeing nothing else on your screen? Very good. Okay, so this is the middle part of the teaching of dependent origination. And I think for me, this gives a very, very clear understanding of what the end of dukkha is. And again, this may be the most fundamental teaching of the Buddha. To me, this and the two arrows gives a clearer understanding of what the Four Noble Truths is getting at. So here are the four. This is the middle of dependent origination, which is a teaching about how, really about the origins of dukkha. And this is the middle part, which is based on someone having core ignorance, sort of spiritual ignorance, and a lot of bad habits. And then, but everyone goes through the same cycle too. But what happens if we have the underlying ignorance and bad habits is that we will go very quickly from what is on this slide from stages 1 to 4. And so it's possible though for us to not go from 1 to 4. So let me explain. So contact, as many of us know, is simply the ordinary experience of the senses, which, and for the Buddha, includes thinking and the mind. So we see something, we hear something, we smell something, we have physical sensations, I think something, and this is just ordinary experience. That leads to the feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And, you know, that is probably dependent on habits to some extent just the nature of the experience, the nature of the contact. And so I taste a cookie, I have a pleasant feeling tone. You know, I see someone I like, I have a pleasant feeling tone. I have a difficult experience in my body, painful experience, I have an unpleasant feeling tone. Someone says something I don't like, someone has a political idea I don't like, I have an unpleasant feeling tone. So far, this is sort of neutral in a certain sense, and everyone is experiencing this. Where there is this habitual ignorance and where there are essentially bad habits, I will go from the pleasant feeling tone to wanting something and then grasping after it. In the case of the cookie, I will want another cookie, and I will grasp after it. A lot of times we go from contact to grasping like this. Bam, bam. someone says something nasty, I go right back. In a similar way, I go from an unpleasant feeling tone to not wanting something. I don't want that pain in my shoulder, and I instantly push it away, you know, in a reactive way. And I'm going to say that the nature of dukkha is the grasping or the pushing away, very similar to shooting the second arrow, which is in the text, it's framed especially in terms of the unpleasant. But I would say that reactivity has two forms, grasping after the pleasant and pushing away the unpleasant. Now, I'll stop the screen share. And I'll say immediately that there's an interesting complication with reactivity. I'm going to say that the core meaning of dukkha is reactivity. And that's a better way to get at the meaning of the end of dukkha than suffering. It also makes it clear what the purpose of our practice is, which is to end reactivity, or more specifically, to end grasping after the pleasant and the pushing away of the unpleasant. Now, important to say that the quality of grasping and pushing away and the reactivity has a habitual, unconscious, and automatic quality to it. And one of the complications, which I think we can maybe see very, very quickly, is that very often I can be reactive about, let's say, something pleasant that might be skillful to go after. I can be very reactive about something that's unpleasant that I might want to stop or to end. So, for example, one of the clearest examples, I can be very reactive about injustice, right? This is a major complication in terms of the nature of reactivity, which points to the fact that reactivity is the kind of the pushing away on in an automatic, unconscious, compulsive way. But what I'm pushing away, I may want to end. I can be very reactive about injustice, but I still want to end injustice. I can be very reactive about my coworker who didn't keep an agreement, but I still may want to talk about my coworker about that agreement. I can be very reactive and just grab at the second cookie, but it might be skillful for me to eat the second cookie, right? What that points to, and this is why I think this is a major complication with our practice. One way that I like to have found myself saying it is that reactivity is complex. It involves often some kind of that reactivity can get mixed up with something that can be valuable. Again, we can see this most clearly with injustice. I see it a lot when I work with transforming the judgmental mind. You know, that's another good example. I can be judgmental about my coworker who didn't keep the agreement, but I had it, my judgment, as it were, contains an insight that's valuable. And so we don't so much get rid of the judgment, but I separate out what's valuable that gets mixed up with the reactivity. I transform the reactivity and preserve the insight about injustice or about my coworker. Or maybe I preserve a need that I've been very grasping about. I grasp after this relationship, but what I want to do is separate out the reactivity. That's a major part of our practice, isn't it? And it complicates things, right? It means that I want to look at my reactivity, but understand that it often gets mixed up with something that's valuable. A major complication of our practice. So I'll finish by pointing to how we then practice. The first thing is that we want to study our reactivity. We want to be mindful of when we're reactive. And what I'll be inviting us to do is to practice with reactivity, practice with dukkha in the next week. So we want to study all the ways that we are reactive, all the ways that there's dukkha. What are my main forms of reactivity? What are my top five? What are my top 10? Where am I reactive? Am I reactive with food? Am I reactive in my relationships? Am I, again, grabbing as well as pushing away? Am I reactive with political ideas? Many of us, all of those areas. So I want to study my reactivity. If I can I be mindful of the reactivity in the moment? Let me explore it. Let me see what it's like. And one thing that becomes important when we're being mindful of reactivity, clarify the level of intensity of the reactivity. Some forms of reactivity are too much for our mindfulness. If we're getting really, really reactive, like really enraged about something, then we want to come back to balance and find a way to do that. And that we can't, sometimes the reactivity is too much for mindfulness, but we can very often be mindful of our reactivity, study it, develop forms of non-reactivity, like mindfulness, like loving kindness, like the other heart practices. Find ways to hang out more and more with non-reactive states. So be mindful, study our forms of reactivity, be mindful of reactivity when it's happening. If you notice yourself reactive in a moment, take a pause in the middle of the day. Studying our reactivity is right at the center of ending dukkha. And so we study it. We also, I think, remember we really want to be guided by the wisdom teachings like the two arrows. Remember the two arrows. When we're having something difficult happen, look out for the tendency to shoot the second arrow. The guidance that I most give when I'm doing one-on-one work, someone's having something difficult happen, I guide the person, watch out for your tendency to shoot the second arrow. Watch out for the tendency for dukkha to be there. We want to bring in another way of practicing is to really bring in the heart practices. Because if we're looking a lot at dukkha, we're looking into what's challenging or difficult. And so any studious practitioner with dukkha, I think, needs to be doing regular metta, regular heart practice, because just to give us some balance, it also balances sort of the wisdom dimension with the resting and the kind heart. And maybe the last thing I'll say is that then we want to see when there's reactivity, can I have a non-reactive response to the situation? And this could entail all sorts of other practices, with my coworker who didn't keep the agreement. I may need to do inner work with my reactivity. I may need to really be diligent about non-reactive speech when I talk to the person, right? So this is where the, teaching about dukkha and the end of dukkha brings in wise speech. It can bring in skillful work with conflict. It can bring in nonviolent social action. I think that the teaching about dukkha and the end of dukkha unifies all of our practice. We could have a 4-year Buddhist university curriculum totally structured around the core teaching, because I think it's right at the center of what we do, what we aspire to. And it can go off in all these different directions, go off into psychological dimensions, go off into wise speech, go into skillful work with conflict, go into nonviolent social action, and so forth. So that's what I want to offer, that, this, what I hope is a clear way of talking about what we're really up to. All of the practices up to is about ending dukkha. And so I'll just end by repeating what the Buddha said. I teach dukkha and the end of dukkha. Thank you. Let's take a moment and just see how that landed. And again, a lot of it probably familiar, maybe some things not so familiar. See what may have been helpful. See where there is a question. So please let me invite any reflection or question or sharing. Looks like Patty and then Vita. Please, Patty.
Thank you, Donald. That was very helpful. I had heard those four kinds of dukkha before, but never in the context of how to understand the end of dukkha. So that was very helpful. I want to clarify something or share something and ask for clarification.
Okay.
You defined the second arrow as reactivity. And maybe this is just a form of reactivity, but often for me, the second, and it's never just one, it's usually subsequent arrows.
Right.
Come in the form of storytelling.
Yeah.
And I tell stories about the first arrow.
Yeah.
And when I can catch myself telling stories, I realize I'm adding to the dukkha. But is telling stories reactivity? It's not really blaming or lashing out. It's just like making up stories, trying to justify or making up stories, why me, or any kind of story that keeps me at the center of the show.
Yeah. Thanks, Patty. Several very helpful points there. I think that, when you're the first of all, the second arrow is shorthand for the second through the 4,873rd arrow, from all the way, we shoot multiple arrows. Second arrow is sort of code for that. And it occurs in every dimension of experience. It occurs at the level of the body. It occurs in our emotions. It occurs in our thinking, in our ideas. The basic idea is that it's driven by reacting against the unpleasant, or pushing away the unpleasant, or grabbing hold of the pleasant. And so we can have our stories do that. You know, our stories will give us, someone says something I don't like, I develop all sorts of stories about that person, maybe even going into childhood experiences, and this is why this person is this way. And that's part of the second arrow, or part of the reactivity. Yeah. It's part of the pushing away. So yeah, that's helpful that there are all sorts of forms that the second arrow takes, or that the reactivity takes.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing out those points. Yeah. So, stories about the first arrow, that shouldn't have happened, or, like my example, I tripped over something my partner left. Why did my partner do that? My partner's always leaving stuff. I trip, I hope I'm lucky I haven't had serious injuries, and I go on and on, right? Papancha. Okay. Great. And I think Vita, and then it looks like Barbara Bill.
Yeah. Donald, this is really a whole new concept for me. So my confusion, I have a lot of confusion, but particular confusion is, so the dukkha is a grasp. So it's the grasp, reactivity is the grasping or pushing away.
Right.
And then you talk about, which makes sense, but I like some clarification.
Okay.
That I think you used the word justice.
Yeah.
Which is something you grasp because you want it. But That whole bit about the dichotomy of reacting and pushing away and still wanting it.
Right. That's what I can. Yeah, I jump in now, Vita, or should
please.
You say more? Yeah. Now that's where it gets very complicated, and where even the very some of the terms used, like grasping or pushing away, don't really connote what I think the Buddha's getting at, which is something about the habitual, compulsive, automatic, often unconscious quality of all of this. That's what I think is at the core of reactivity. It has those qualities. And so even a word like grasping, yeah, we can use language like I grasp for justice. Mm-hmm. And so, but the Buddha's getting at something unconscious, so more compulsive, unconscious, habitual in the sense, again, of automatic and unconscious. And so what I was saying is that we can be very reactive in relation to something which is skillful to go after or to, in a sense, want. You know, so again, this gets into tricky material. And the, you know, so for example, the Buddha did talk about things that it was good to desire. But presumably, there's a whole different mechanism when I want to awaken, as opposed to when I want my 14th chocolate chip cookie, right? I use, in English, I use the same word, but there's something different happening. And it maybe goes beyond some of our language, but the Buddha did have words for skillful desire. And so I think we would say something like, there's a skillful wanting of justice or of health. And of course, we can be very automatic and grasping in terms of good things. That's what I was saying was the complication. You know, and I can see injustice and demonize my opponent and be really, really reactive. And arguably, that's not so skillful, even if noticing the injustice is really important. So a lot of complications, but I think you're getting at something. And so we have to have some precision about the language, but what's being got at here is that reactivity is something automatic, habitual. It's coming from pushing away the unpleasant or grabbing hold of the pleasant without consciousness, mindfulness, and wisdom. Yeah. But thank you. And, you know, and most teachers or even the Buddha didn't lay out something just, you know, like I just said, it takes some, have to be fairly precise with the language to get at a lot of this where there can be confusion. Yeah. I think Barbara and Bill and then Carolyn.
Yes, I want to thank you. I think what you're talking about is so, so important. The whole idea of reactivity and what it can, when you're pursuing something positive. I think the word of wholesome desire, I think, isn't in Chanda? Chanda?
Right, Chanda, yeah.
But I was thinking, and particularly for me, I was thinking, what is something I'm very reactive about? It's bigotry. It's, you know, yeah. Be in the face of bigotry and not do something not wise and not skillful and just being reactive in that, in something that in some ways is a great evil.
Yeah.
And how to concretely manage that. You know, I was just reading about this in the University of Arizona and their multicultural center. A white guy came up against a black woman and a black trans person and some other people. And it turned into this horrible, horrible confrontation with a video with 4 million followers and, you know, terrible trolling and, you know, just insults and, you know, threats. And it was just terrible. And it starts out with just reactivity. And part of what happens, too, is the other later steps of dependent origination when there's selfing going on. that you create a righteous self and you create a concerned self, even a quote unquote good self. And can you talk a little about sort of how to deal with something like facing evil in reactivity?
Yeah. Or we could say that righteous reactivity is one of the great dangers of, I guess, any political side. But, you know, I think we can see it among so-called progressives very clearly, sort of being reactive and righteous and demonizing of opponents. So, over self-righteousness and demonizing are signs of reactivity. And so how then do we relate to things that are extremely harmful, like bigotry? And, you know, again, we have exemplars. You know, you can look at someone like Dr. King, you know, and it's said that Dr. King, he said that his work was for the bodies of Black people and the souls of white people.
Well, that, I've never heard that. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it's quite powerful. And he recognized the soul damage of hatred. So that's where we can bring in compassion to start, right? And we can also, know the history and, you know, have a wisdom about how it's, you know, I mean, I don't have time to give it. I gave some talks several years ago on how racism originates in the divide and conquer strategy by the economic and political elites and right up to the present day. So you can have a wisdom perspective, compassion perspective, and it helps one to be more understanding, more compassionate, less reactive, even towards something that has been horrendous for centuries. And then in the, you know, in the, those help. And then, of course, in terms of our, you know, our own personal practice, of course, we can bring mindfulness to our own reactivity in relation to bigotry. We can bring in compassion practice. So we can bring in our usual practice on a personal level. And then also try to use skillful speech. If you have a cousin who espouses views that may be bigoted, right? Or you have relations with people. So there's all the usual practices of mindfulness, compassion, loving kindness, skillful speech would be all ways of working those on a more personal level.
Yeah, I think that's wonderful. I also think about cultivating the pause. You mentioned that.
That's right. Yeah.
As if it's, what harm am I going to be doing here with my response? You know, who am I?
That's right. Or if you're in a difficult interaction, becoming reactive, you know, if you have the other person, especially if the other person's practitioner, you can say, could we both pause?
Yeah.
This is like Thich Nhat Hanh's mindfulness bell, which, you know, when I've been with the use of that in groups, it's rung every 20 minutes or so. Everyone pauses for a minute. And it's often in some groups I've been in, it gets rung in any moment of tension. And it's miraculous, right? Pausing is one of the great underrated spiritual practices of our times. Okay. Do we have time to go to, I think, Carolyn? Was that complete for you, Barbara? Yeah, thank you. I didn't hear your last thoughts. You're muted.
I said you could go on forever about it, but yes, thank you very much.
Yeah, but great question, because we want to be able to, as you said, we want to go for what's positive, and we want to be clear. How is that distinguished from grasping? You know, in terms of what's being seen as a problem. And again, the language is imprecise, you know, because like Vita was saying, we can grasp after justice. That makes some sense, even if we don't use that language sometimes. We strive for justice, right? Or whatever. So we want to be careful with the language, but the meaning is, I think ultimately it's some kind of distinction between the positives that are skillful to go after. And again, and then how we do it. am I reactive in relation to the, even a, something, a good thing like justice? Am I reactive towards it, or am I more non-reactive? Okay. Carolyn, I'll have the last one, then we'll go towards our closing.
Hi, first of all, I just wanted to thank you for just bringing a lot more depth of thought to this whole question of why are we doing this?
Yeah.
And when you asked, why are we doing this? I thought, why am I doing this? I learned so much with the practice of meditation.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of, okay, there my mind went over there and I need to bring it back to my breath, recognizing when something changes and when I need to bring it back to it. It just brings a lot more consciousness to my life, you know, yeah, to recognizing that it's easy for me to get swept away, whether it's in reaction or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So that was kind of my answer to why are we doing this? You know, it's really to bring more consciousness into my life. But, you know, the detail that you brought into it from the teachings was very helpful to my own intuition of why am I doing this?
Yeah, yeah. No, it's helpful to, and also our motivation changes over time. You know, like I said, my motivation when I first practiced was to have wonderful states of consciousness, right?
Yeah, I came through yoga, and my desire was to burn karma, you know, so yeah. to really be able to change my life by, you know, burning my karma. And so.
Yeah, yeah. So there's the motivation changes, and there's also a way that there are all these benefits from meditation. We have more mindfulness. We have more concentration. We have more self-knowledge. We have more calm. We have more peace. We have more ability to work with difficulties and so forth. These are all benefits, but it's helpful to remember that there's a passage. I'll paraphrase. There's a passage where the Buddha says, we can have concentration or calm or peace, but none of these are the deep aim of the practice. The aim of the practice is the sure heart's release, or we could say the aim of the practice, the deep fundamental aim of the practice is the end of dukkha. And all the things I just named are supports for that core endeavor. We don't get there without them.
It's the pathway.
It's a pathway, and they're path tools. And we can forget about that. You know, I think a lot of the way, for example, that mindfulness has gone into contemporary Western culture, you know, is about being peaceful or being present or more efficient at work. And often that, you know, the deeper aim isn't part of the offering. So it can help us focus and ask, what am I really after, and can really guide our practice, you know? So yeah, thanks, Carolyn.
Thank you.
And so what I'm going to suggest for the next week, because I come back, the plan is for me to come back in 1 week. What I'd like to invite people to do is to dedicate yourself to working with reactivity. Explore it. Be mindful of it. How many of you would be interested in working with reactivity so we have some continuity between next week and this week, right? Okay. And so look at reactivity in those different ways. I think the ways of practicing that I named were, number one, study your own reactivity, know the different forms. What are your top five, your top 10? Be mindful of reactivity, work with that pause. Know the level of reactivity. Sometimes it's going to be too much for mindfulness. It'll be too intense. then you do something else that helps you come back to balance. Remember the wisdom teachings about the two arrows and the dependent origination, contact to grasping. And I'll send to Bill the slides so he can put that up on the website. So those slides will be there. Okay, so you can download them if you want. And then bring in the heart practices and see if you can have a non-reactive response when there is reactivity. So those are the ways of practicing that I suggested.